foreign company on planet Earth that allow you to measure the complex dielectric constant and complex permeability at any frequency almost DC to light. They've got fixtures. Back to US, K2LIW.
Yeah, by the way, relative static permittivities, and I have a list of them for vacuum error and poison polyamide whatsoever, a pretty interesting table. I have a question for you, which is, what is the negative permittivity? Back to you.
When you say negative, now, are you talking about the complex component of dielectric constant, or do you really mean materials that have negative permeability and negative permittivity? There's a whole series of what are called meta-materials. There's a way of building very elaborate step-and-repeat printed circuits, which across a narrow frequency region do display dielectric constant and permeability that has negative characteristics. In other words, an ordinary material, when a light wave enters the material, the light wave will bend closer to the normal. In this material, the light wave entering the material bends away from the normal. It really is negative. Those are called metamaterials. Synthesized artificial materials. Is that what you're talking about? K2LIW.
Okay, I have structures for exhibit effective negative permeability and permittivity. The text says more or less the near fields originate from the electromagnetic fields being cut off near antennas or in waveguides. The field behavior can be modeled exactly by solving the boundary value problem. Structure related to the field behavior can effectively be obtained from the structure field with the bulk negative permittivity, since the negative permittivity is the pure imaginary, and therefore the fields are dumped. Enter it here.
Well, that's somebody's particular write-up on a particular material, but in the last few years of issues of Microwave Theory and Techniques, the Journal of Microwave Theory and Techniques, the division of the IEEE, quite a few articles, there's probably at least 15 or 20 articles, have been on metamaterials that across a certain narrow frequency region, these materials do display negative permeability or negative permittivity. And sometimes you can synthesize a material that is negative in both simultaneously. There are materials that can do that. Now, the fact that it has negative permittivity or permeability does not mean that it stores negative energy. It's got permeability, it stores energy. That in itself is not going to give you over-unity, if you know what I mean. ODUS, K2RIW.
I agree with you. Yeah, no, I didn't mean that. Although I'm very much in search for that. Another email that I have sent you, which was the part one, was interaction between individual vortexes and the block and a blotch wall. I have sent you, and that was the email 9/23/12. It was sent September 18, 5 days ago. September 18, TechNet, part number one, blotch wall. Now, when you open up, you see the picture. You have a Linux or Unix system. It will not really show you the same way as it shows in PCs. The picture which shows a induction coil and the suspended aluminium in it that is not falling down. It's simply suspended. Enter it here. September 18, 5 days ago, TechNet 9/23/12, part one, blotch wall.
that picture. I see the coil of wire that has a funny loop in the first turn, and I see the dielectric heated material, which I think is being melted, and the material is being suspended. I think I see that diagram. Go ahead, Wes.
Yes, and then on the left-hand side, you see the black roll. I included some of the information about the black roll region. I wonder if you're familiar with that. Now, if you have a magnet, in a magnet, the region on the left-hand side, you see that the region in the middle is the black roll. Also, the region that this metal is suspended and levitating is the region of the black roll. Now, if you look at that coil, the coil starts to the right clockwise, and then all of a sudden it changes direction counterclockwise. Now, that's the proof that the black hole doesn't have to be created in within the magnet by itself, but it could be artificially created.
Yeah, this is a fairly new material to me, and I don't have an explanation for what's happening there, Wes.
Okay, so interesting. I have in that email you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 short videos that at any time if you're interested you can go to that, and it is giving you a different levitation. Because this is probably gonna end up in Bernie's family. So everybody will have or is already there, access to it. It's levitation of the objects, and what they do is they drop into the coil a piece of the metal, and the metal doesn't go down, it simply hangs up, and it's levitating. All of a sudden, because of the temperature and the eddy current, is going to melt and create a ball. Now, you see on this picture, you don't see the bowl because the structure was made this way that actually the upper part gives you half of sphere and the other one gives you kind of egg shape. But interesting stuff. And I'm going to go to another one.
Out of curiosity, Wes, you are pursuing this one because of its intellectual curiosity. You don't necessarily have a direct application for this device at this time. Is that sort of true?
Well, basically, we had a discussion about the magnetism and how the magnetism is contained within the magnet. And we didn't finish that, but it was interesting. I was trying to find a comparison to the magnet in the artificial world created by the man. Let me drop. The interaction between the black hole in the ferrite creates also vortex. We were talking about line of the flux, and everybody said, oh, there is no vortex. The line of flux goes from the south to northern whatsoever. Well, in the picture that you have over there, actually the lower picture, you see that in a certain situation, you have a vortex created, and a certain attraction observed between the vortexes in the black hole. Also, the black hole, when you look at the magnet and the structure, is turning. So you see the motion in it. Now, we know that the magnetic field is static, but at the same time we see the motion. We look at the magnet over there. So the vector is gradually changing from the north to south. Any further comments on it, and then we go further?
No, I'm not familiar with this material. I did look at a number of those emails and those YouTube videos, and I don't have experience in this area. By the way, when it comes to pronunciations, you very frequently will pronounce the word basically as bicycly. You might want to pronounce it basically, not bicycly. Some people will have trouble understanding what you mean by bicycly. Over to you, Wes, KQRIW.
Beautiful, your favorite one. Basically, thank you very much. I appreciate you correcting my English. I'm trying my best, basically. Thank you. There is an email, but I'm going to briefly touch it and leave it for another night, which is the email that was sent to you, and I didn't discuss it with the channel. Usually I do it. This is the email from September 19, 4 days ago. And this one is part number two, 1919 science, they have seen the wireless transmission. How 1919 science have seen the wireless transition? The time of Marconi, California plant, and here is on this article, very precisely a Tesla patent, not only Tesla article written about one wire communication and communication over the air.
N2LU with a question.
So while you're looking at it, there is a quote standing in here in that this kind of a communication could go easily around the globe. Just for your curiosity, I'm going to touch it up next week. That is kind of puzzling me. The information that are in this email are available at boringfamily.com.
N2 Lima Uniform. Go right ahead, Lou. What's your question?
Good evening, Dick. I have a very, very simple question, far simpler than the discussion that's going on. May I ask the question, or do you want to continue with this complex conversation? I need some help in solving a simple problem. May I go ahead?
So I have these guys, I have just last thing to go, which is electrostatic, doesn't have to really be discussed. Go ahead, guys.
You got it, Lou. Go ahead with your question.
Thank you. Give me a second, let me get my book. It's a calculation that I don't understand. I don't know how to calculate the answer, and to you it'll be simple. Just bear with me while I get the book, and I'll read the question to you. It says, a one-quarter watt film resistor, 1% resistance, must be soldered to a resisted circuit board foil pattern. The size of iron wattage is, it gives you 250 watts, 150, 45, and 100 watts. The answer is 45 watts, but I don't know how they calculate it. I've never seen this before. Could you help?
Okay, you're going to have to repeat the question, Lou. We had a number of dropouts on that transmission. If you have a little bit more power, it would help. So about 50% of your transmission was a dropout. I heard quarter watt, I heard film resistor, I heard higher power resistors, and I'm not quite sure what the question is. Back to you, Lou. N2LU, K2RIW.
K2LIW, N2LU. Question. I hope that the echo link is working correctly. The question is, a one-quarter watt film a 1% resistance tolerance must be soldered to a printed circuit board for the pattern. Of the soldering iron. One watt, C, 5 watts, C, 5 watts. The answer is 45. I don't know how it was. I've never seen anything like this before. Could you help?
Okay, we only heard one third of your words, Lou. We heard one third of your words. The rest was a dropout. I heard quarter watt film resistor. 1%. I heard something about foil. I heard something about soldering to a printed circuit board. And then I heard 45 watts. Right now, that's not enough raw material for me to put together what the question is. Want to try again? N2LU, K2RIW.
Dick, maybe he's asking the size of the soldering iron needed. Trying to understand it.
Go ahead, Lou. Has a very characteristic view to the printed circuit conductor. So my best guess is that they're making a recommendation, and I don't think anything is going to explode if you use a soldering iron that's bigger or smaller or a different type. Proper soldering is more a acquired skill of properly using whatever materials you've got. The exact materials make it a little easier or a little bit harder. You can use the exact correct materials, and if you do it improperly, you can get a very poor solder joint. You can use terrible materials, but use it with skill and get a good solder joint. And the solder joint, if you don't get it right the first time, you're allowed to repeat the process until you finally get it right, with rare exception. Other are certain situations where you eventually wear away some coatings, but that's not so not so prevalent. So you might be worrying unnecessarily about the size of the soldering iron required for this operation, Lou. N2LU, K2 Romeo, India, Whiskey.
K2 Romeo, India, Whiskey. November 2, Lima, Uniform, via Echo Link. Thank you, Dick. I had that basic knowledge. However, is there a calculation for coming up with the answer? They're asking, they're giving you a 1/4 watt film resistor. It says 1% resistance tolerance, and it's being soldered to a foil pattern, and they ask the desired soldering iron wattage. I assume there's a calculation for determining this question, and that's what I'm trying to get at. Is there a calculation to determine the amount of wattage, heat, to solder this 1/4 resistor to a foil pattern? Is there a calculation? Limark.net, November 2, Lima Uniform, via Echo Link.
At that time, we heard the whole transmission. You were lucky. And no, there is no calculation. It's a matter of experience. A skilled person will say, gee, that very fat resistor lead, which has a lot of thermal specific heat to it, and the very large foil on the printed circuit board, which has a lot of heat sinking capability, somebody may have said that from my experience, a 45-watt iron or larger is required to do a good job. Is that a calculation? I doubt it highly. Now, I've never seen a book where you start off with known dimensions of materials and calculate the size of iron. Somebody who built the circuit for the first test run may have discovered that a 20-watt iron was not enough, and he then went to the next size larger that was available to him, and he's telling you to use 45 watts. That's a guess. But no, that's not a calculation. That would be a very difficult calculation. We're talking about what kind of solder, what kind of temperature has to be achieved, how fast the heat is being drained from the iron when you first make contact, and so on. What temperatures must be achieved in order for that particular flux of that particular solder to properly clean away the oxide so that the solder will properly wick. There's all kinds of irons that you can use. It's more a problem of the proper application and skill rather than the size of the material, the size of the equipment you use for doing the soldering. So, as I said, the exact right iron can give you a really lousy solder job if you don't have the skill, and vice versa.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The wrong soldering iron can still do a good job if the person has sufficient soldering skill. You might be worrying unnecessarily, Lou. N2LU, K2LIW.
Yes, sir, Jack.
Go ahead, whoever just called me. Was that Eric?
Yes. it's really all about temperature and time, Dick. You know, I do say this now, it's a big resistance. You want to use a 50-watt iron, 100-watt iron, no problem. It's a matter of time. It's start at most at a specific temperature. Generally, I set my iron to 700 degrees, okay? You put it on there, you wait a moment, get hot enough to melt the solder, let it do its thing, and get off of there. That's it.
When you said 700 degrees that you set your iron, I presume that's Fahrenheit. Is that true, Eric?
That's Fahrenheit. I'll set it to about 360 Celsius. You know, take your pick. Generally, most electronic soldering irons, they come with the thermostat set around 700, or 720, depends on the tip.
And when you do soldering with Rojas solder versus ordinary lead tin 6040, do you change the temperature, Eric?
You're supposed to, but I don't, you know. You're supposed to clean it. Actually, you're supposed to use a completely different iron so you don't contaminate it, but I don't. But then again, you know, I work on something that's built Rojas, and to heck with it, I use lead solder.
Yeah, I've also collected lead solder because the Rojas is much more of a trouble than it's worth. And I presume the Rojas solders do require a higher temperature than the old-fashioned 6040. Is that true?
In some cases it is, in some cases it isn't. It depends on the mixture and who you bought it from and whether you're using a paste or you're using a solid core.
N2LU, may I take it?
You've got it, Luke.
Well, thank you very much all for your input. The question asked, the desired size of the soldering iron wattage is. Well, before I came to you, I think it was chapter 23, page I forgot. There's a in the ARRL handbook, and there's quite a large section in there. On soldering techniques, so on and so forth. I thought that there was, from the question, it sounds like there's some formula to determine the amount of wattage, heat, that's required to blah, blah, blah. The final question is, the desired size of the soldering iron wattage is, and then they give you four different answers, 250, 150, 45, and 100 watts. Gentleman said he uses 700 watts. I've used the soldering iron, I turn it up high. I'm not sure what wattage is at, but I know that technique is everything. This is a question that asks the desired size of the soldering iron wattage, and that was based on that 1/4 watt film resistor, 1% tolerance, and it's being soldered to a foil, on a circuit board. I thought there was a calculation for it. I went through the ARRL handbook, page by page by page by page. There was nothing in there. That's when I threw the towel in and came to you. TechNet, this is November 2, Lima Uniform. Most gracious for your help. Back to you.
Again, may I pick up?
Hey, Dick, you know, there actually is a set of formulas. It's all about thermal conductivity.
Okay, I don't think he has to go through a calculation, though. He sets it at 700 watts. I think he means he sets it at 700 degrees Fahrenheit. But you've seen a calculation, Eric? Is that what you're saying? KE2EJ? K2LIW?
Yeah, when most semiconductors, if you're doing surface mount stuff, you'll find... Let it drop. If you look at the spec sheets of most surface mount material, they will give you a curve of thermal conductivity per pad placement and a timing of two stages of soldering, depending on whether you're soldering manually or soldering automated. generally, when you're working with surface mount stuff, you'll preheat the board to around 400 degrees. You put it, I actually have a preheater, which you lay the board down on, which gets the board warm. It's under the thermal conductivity of the semiconductors or the resistors or capacitors that you're using. And then there's actually a formula for square area. I think it's, I don't know whose constant it is. It's, is it Boltzmann? I forget. But there's a time element where you bring it to the actual melting temperature of the solder, and then you have to let it cool down to a specific rate. I have not seen anything like that for heavy-duty leaded components, but there is also a set of formulas for FR4 and various different types of PC boards, because the glues are also sensitive to heat in terms of time, how long you can conduct the heat on a given size pad, and the amount of square area the pad is, etc.
Have a comment?
Go ahead with your comment.
We're talking about a person who wants to solder something and he doesn't want to the point to pop out from it, but he wants to see the solder being liquid. So the easiest way is just put your soldering gun on it exactly to the point and make sure that you have enough of solvent. As soon as you see the liquid, just leave it away. That's it. Simple like that. There is nothing more to invent about it. No matter what we say that the manufacturers do, whatever the equation is, it doesn't matter. It's a simple operation, and I believe if you give it to the child 9 years old, he'll be able to do it if you show him how to do it.
You know, there is a mil spec for that, too.
Tell us about that, Eric. And by the way, Erica, there was an earlier question tonight about a decibel meter that operates at 600 ohms. I am guessing that is an audio circuit. I think at one time, standard audio circuits were all 600 ohms, and I believe a audio measuring meter in dBm covers audio frequencies up to 20 or 50 kilohertz. He wants to use it at 2 megahertz. I'm a little bit worried about the meter's calibration up there. I think it's going to have to be recalibrated. You might have some opinions on that one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2J. If you want to get specific about that, I mean, if we're talking about 600 ohm audio circuits, okay. A 0 VU, for generally audio meters are in VU, not VBM. But there are several audio standards, all terminated at 600 ohms, like Marbell or Verizon or whomever you want to call them. They have a standard, which is actually plus 8 dBm, is equivalent to 0 VU on a VU meter. Typically, in the analog broadcast audio, we have a tendency, I happen to like to use 0 dBm as 0 VU, but most audio gear will allow you to select whether 0, plus 4, or plus 8. Those are the standards that we use. Most VU meters, if they're not peak reading meters, have a weighting filter in them. And
Eric, did you pass it back to us? Did your battery go dead? Did something happen? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Where'd you lose me, Dick? I lost my battery.
You had just told us that you can set the meter for 0 plus 4 or plus 8 dBm to be 0 VU. And I'm wondering if some of these meters also contain a particular frequency response curve, RIAA or something like that. I'm a little bit worried about whether or not his meter is really going to give him reasonable response where he intends to use it at 2 megahertz. Back to you, Eric. KQLIW.
I got a different radio. What I was saying is that whether or not it's a peak reading meter or not, the meters don't have a curve, but they have a waiting filter, or rather a waiting circuit. Most audio video meters or peak reading audio meters will not pass anything about 30 kilohertz, simply because of the circuitry and the way they're designed. They are designed specifically for the audio spectrum, and they are generally flat, but their waiting circuit is all about averaging.
Oh-ho. So if I gave it a continuous sine wave and swept it from 20 kilohertz, from 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz, I think you're saying it would be flat. But now if I put speech to it and I change the high-frequency response versus the low-frequency response of the speech, I think you're saying the way it averages changes versus frequency. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. That doesn't hold true for a PPM or a peak reading meter. Peak reading meters, that's just what it is, peak reading meter. You change the frequency response of what you're putting in, it's still reading the peaks of the voltage that's coming in.
So since many of them contain a 30 kilohertz low-pass filter, or some other kind of circuit that doesn't respond well above 30 kilohertz, maybe it's a slow diode, I think you're saying his chances of getting good operation at 2 megahertz are not very encouraging. Is that what you're saying, Eric?
I seriously doubt that you'll get them to pass 2 megahertz, period. You've got to consider most meters in the professional world, okay, believe it or not, we still have a tendency to use input transformers, and most good audio meters read 600 ohms balanced, not unbalanced. Okay, if you want to go single-ended, then you start to talk about high impedance meters. You know, there's multiple audio standards. There's the AES standard, which we use in broadcasting and a lot of other things. There's something called IHF, which is actually based on 10K, which is typical of your home consumer products, which has phono connectors.
So you're saying an RCA phono plug might be operating at 10 kilo ohms of apparent impedance, in which case the length of that cable is going to change your high frequency response, isn't it?
That's why they don't recommend that you run, miles of it. You want to run miles of audio cable, you're going to use balanced audio cable anyway. But yeah, the back of your hi-fi, it's IHF, which is international hi-fi, believe it or not, and that standard is based around 10,000 ohms. And it's high impedance. You'll find that there are some variations, like you'll find a phono, a turntable connector, which is actually a bit, is it lower or higher? No, I think it's lower impedance. That's usually the exception to the rule, where is that your tuners, the output of your DVD player, the output of your TV sets, they're all based on 10K.
10K and approximately 1 volt RMS, something like that, Eric?
I think it's 600 millivolts.
So I think you're saying the full volume is 600 millivolts on a 10K circuit for both the input and the output connectors, RCA phono plugs, on those auxiliary audio circuits of, say, a TV set. In the case of a turntable, that much lower impedance, I presume, is the old-fashioned dynamic cartridge. Is that true?
Yeah, that was the moving... Well, we're talking about moving coil. We're not talking about piezo. Piezo is a... Oh, even higher, I think they're like 20K or 30K, something like that. But you will find that when you hook into a phono connector, there's a bit more gain associated with it.
KC2, QIQ.
Glenn recognized. One quick question, Eric. How long ago was a vinyl record really played over a broadcast station? Isn't that something that's almost ancient history? Over to you, Eric, and then pass it over to Glenn. KE2EJ, KQLIW.
think, in history. But there's still some stations that are into playing vinyl around the country. I don't know if we have any stations in New York that do that, but there's a few of them. But you can still get turntables, although they're, might I add, they're very expensive because they, you know, super balanced turntables and all through whoopee-doo tone-ons and extremely rare phono cartridges and needle inserts. But yeah, so, but you can consider that all ancient history. Most radio stations that you're listening to, you're listening to a computer. 62QIQ, take it, K2J.
Yeah, good evening, guys. I actually got here, in, here late this evening, but interesting topic about the 10K input impedance. And my question is actually for you, Eric, because you seem to be familiar a lot with the standard at 10K. And I do a lot of stuff here with audio equipment, and one of the things that always bothered me about that standard, about the 10K ohm, is that it seems like a lot of the inputs are all 10K or something close to 10K ohms. So in other words, like if you have the input, the preamp inputs, they're all somewhere around 10K. But what's interesting is like the preamp outputs, they're driving those inputs or from CD players and everything else. They seem to be much, much lower. And I'm wondering, I guess that's really a unbalanced system. I don't think that's a balanced system, right? Because in other words, typically the source impedance that can go up to like 2.5 volts, I think, on those preamps for the solid state gear at 10K on the input side. So it's kind of like 10K on the input side and like low impedance, like 1K or less, sometimes from the driving side. I was wondering, maybe you could spread some light on that. It always kind of confused me. Now back to you, Eric. K2EJ, KC2QIQ.
All right, Glenn, I was going to actually mention that. The source impedance, okay, it's an old game. I'll give you an example. And for example, I'll take you into the broadcast world for a second to give you an idea of the real world why. You're absolutely correct. Source impedance of most hi-fi stuff runs anywhere between 2 and 5K. There's a reason for that. But here's the real kicker that'll get you going. Say, for example, like you're doing a pool feed. You've got the White House, you're feeding maybe 3 or 4 dozen radio stations, right? So you know you're going to go into their source, their input terminations, you're all going to be at 600 ohms. But how do you drive all that stuff? You need some oomph, okay? So what we'll generally do is we'll take 8, maybe 12 ohms or 22 ohms, or some people will use a 70-volt transformer, which is around, I think it's around 60 ohms, the output impedance of that. You can take from a lower impedance and drive higher impedance inputs without worrying about somebody loading you down. Because when you have all of those 600-ohm impedances together, you're putting them in parallel. The impedance of the whole system is going to drop. The same idea went for the hi-fi world. Is you may take an output and put it into a Y cable, or put it into 2 Y cables, or put it into 3 Y cables. You can always drive from a lower impedance into a higher impedance input. You can't do the reverse. KQ2QIQ, KQ2J.
Yeah, I got you on that one, Eric, for sure. I'm kind of familiar with that. But I guess the one thing that's kind of confusing is that if I probably wanted to do a highly noise-canceling circuit, in other words, like Dick was talking about doing something for like miles or very, very long distances, and you really had a specific, you know, 600 ohm on one side, and maybe you had a driving impedance of 600 ohms on the other side, and did it as a real balanced, I would think you might get a little bit more noise, common mode noise, rejection, other things. But I've never done it in practice. KC2QIQ.
Well, that's the whole point of using balanced cable. I can run a balanced 600-ohm line. Don't forget it's shielded too, which gives you help. And generally, the wire sizes are pretty thick. Wire sizes will be something like 18 gauge, 16 gauge even at times. You do a really long run, but you can run it for, you know, 1,000 feet and still have good results without having a noise issue.
So I think you're saying the twisted pair might be something like 100,
150 ohms, twisted pair, maybe a little bit more, in the shield. And then as long as it's properly terminated at the far end, you could run 1,000 feet of it, and 20 hertz to 20 kc, it could end up almost flat, is what I think you're saying. And a little bit of roll-off because of skin resistance, a skin effect at the higher frequencies, can probably be pre-emphasized in order to correct for it. That's a bunch of guesses on my part, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Suggesting, but in fact, no, we don't. Actually, most audio gear, if you're doing a fixed path and it's going to be a permanent installation, you put something called an equalizer at the back end, and if you're really smart, you put it at the front end and boost it, not have one at the back end. So it depends upon what you're doing and what guy is doing it.
What's the longest audio run you've ever used, Eric, or that you're aware of?
When we used to do live from Lincoln Center and we simulcast on WQXR, when WQXR used to be owned by the New York Times, I think that path was something like from the station to the station. I think it was, and it was a dry pair, by the way. I think it was something like 8 miles, but not short. I mean, we've done stuff that's down to Washington, so you got to figure it's 300-400 miles, but that's considered to be a dry pad, but it has help along the way.
You said the word dry pad or dry pair. Does that mean it is or isn't shielded or doesn't have dielectric around it? What does dry pair mean?
A dry pair is a pair of wires with no electronics in between the source and the termination.
And without source and terminate, without any electronics in between, you have run as long as 8 miles, is that what I've heard you say? And how many dB of loss did you get at the high frequency end when you did that?
So when you do that, you use a Western Electric, what was it, a 648B. It's basically a pre-equalizer and a post-equalizer. The attenuation, I think, was around, for that length, I think we were running about 4.5 dB. It wasn't that bad.
And you were driving some number of volts at the input end in order to get that signal with reasonable fidelity and signal-to-noise ratio at the far end?
No. We were getting better results than the transmitter would be able to produce. If that gives you an idea that yeah, you know, that technology is no longer used because we do it digitally these days, but they started doing that stuff in the early 50s when Western Electric started making gear for it. But, you know, they started with tubes, so it wasn't as noise-free as the solid state stuff was. But, yeah, that wasn't uncommon. And the dry pair, by the way, goes into the big black hunk of cable that's got, you know, a couple of thousand pairs in it because it's got its telephone circuit.
Yeah, here's my next question. On a purely passive, old-fashioned Ma Bell telephone, what's the longest distance I might have between my handpiece in my home and the central office? How many miles might that be with or without amplification and still get reasonable audio? Over to you, and is that 600 ohm system? Over to you, Eric.
All right, if you're talking about 48-volt telephone cable, there's a limit. I think it's the limit. I don't remember what it is. I could look it up. It's something in the order of, you know, between you and the central offices without any loading parts along the way. It's something like 25 miles, something like that. It's not a ridiculous figure, but it's not something that you would want them to have high-quality audio with without doing something to it.
So if I understand you correctly, some old-fashioned telephone circuits might have been as long as 25 miles from that carbon microphone sending the signal through a hybrid in that handpiece, 25 miles to the central office with no amplification in between, all in that great big black cable with 600 other twisted pair in there. Wow. And that was still usable audio. Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
So
could get somebody on here from Marbell, I'm sure they could tell you a lot of good stories about that. But yeah, there's something ridiculous like that. And, you know, if you're really curious about it, you can find out how far your house is from your central office. And I bet you it's on the order of something like 10 miles, 15 miles, something like that. And if I wanted a DSL circuit from my house to the central office, I think that can't go any longer than, what is it, 2 miles or so, Eric, go ahead. Now, I believe with the new ADSL codex, you get about 15,000 feet, which I guess is less than 3 miles, a little more than 2 miles. And then I presume there's some kind of an audio automatic gain control circuit that boosts that audio in the old days before it goes into a so-called long distance. If I'm calling long distance, those are the words they used in, let me pick a number, 1945. I'm calling long distance. I presume there was some kind of amplification in there. Is that true, Eric? Let me let this drop for a second.
N2LU, additional question? N2LU, additional question, please. N2LU, additional question, please, Dick.
Dick? Hey, Dick. Okay, it's already time for the repeater to die, so we'll pick this up next week. Anyway, if you want to, you can go through Sheldon and say goodnight to everybody. K2RWK2J.
The repeater drops out, I believe, at midnight.
KC2QIQ N2LDY, are you out here tonight?
On Echo Link, I believe you have to go to the Sheldon repeater on. This repeater drops out at midnight.
This is N2LDY, and I am on the Sheldon repeater. I understand that. I'm on the 375 machine here, and I'm just seeing who's on the 375 machine.
And you've probably got still some people other than up in Canada listening along.
To Canada, acknowledged. So, John, were you interested in when I threw that thing out there about the iPhone application and how they use the CCD display to monitor gamma radiation? It's pretty cool. When it's doing its calibrate mode, I have the tape over the camera, so it has like a little display window, and so it's sitting there and it's taking background readings. And you can see, like, there's the little display, it's all black. But as time goes on, you see, like, little areas, lighting up, in the display window. So I guess, those are the, when the gamma passed through that particular pixel, it activated it or whatever it does to it. And then it's there. And then I guess at the end of the reading, they must count up the number of pixels, and they probably put it into some kind of algorithm, and they come out with a count per minute from the algorithm. It's pretty cool. I was amazed, when I did it, and I downloaded it, and I tested it, and it worked, and I said, wow, that's great. And also, let me just empty a second. There was some other stuff about, making a detector using pin diodes, seems to be a lot out there, but there weren't too many circuits on it, and a lot of description on, here's the circuit, but, do you have to shield the diode, and how do you do this, and how do you do that, it's pretty vague. It doesn't work. Oh, I don't know, did I double with you or something? Yeah.
I noticed the same noise pattern last night when I was talking to Dick, and it comes and goes. It's amazing.
still on?
This is Victor Echo 7, Lima Tango Delta. 7 LTD, testing 123. This is Victor Echo 7, Lima Tango Delta with an audio test. Audio test 123, the 7 LTD.
Thank you.